Hi, mein Name ist Zalman Lottek. Ich bin der artistische Leiter von der Nationale Jüdische Theater Volksbühne und ich rede mit Reb Saul Solomon auf sein Programm Days Gone By auf UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, here with you. And sometimes I talk to musicians and actors, and we get a little high-tech in what we're talking about. But today, we're getting a little low-tech. Get it? A little Zalman Mlotek, who is one of the people keeping Yiddish alive in a very big and beautiful way. How is he doing this? He's doing this musically, also as artistic director of the longest-running Yiddish theater in the world, in the universe, the Volksbühne, or as it is now called, the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne. And he and his wife are being honored on May 23rd over at Lincoln Center. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the shows that he brought to Broadway. And, of course, we'll talk about Judaism in the Yiddish language. So, will you please welcome to Dave's Gone By, Zalman Mlotek. Shalom!
Shalom, Rabbi. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, could you say that in Yiddish, though? Could you talk a bissel in Yiddish?
Reb Solomon says, Azar fagenigen mit euch zu reden heint auf dein show.
Oh, thank you, Babakash. See, I know a little bit of Hebrew, but I don't know. It's not danke. What was Yiddish for thank you?
A dank.
Shainem dank, of course. Wait, you say shainem. So are you Litvak or Glitz?
Well, you know, it depends when my father wanted to talk to me. He talked to me sometimes in the Galiciana and Litvak. He said when he was with his friends from Warsaw, he would say a shainem dank. But when he was talking to me, he was telling me, teaching me, say a shenem dank. So, that's how.
The complications already, let me tell you. Well, but it's a question that I wanted to ask about Yiddish, because back in the day, let's say pre-1940, when Yiddish was spoken all over the world, I got the impression that it was kind of polyglot, that people threw in their own words, people pronounced things differently, there were very different idioms. Is there now, after the Holocaust, just one basic Yiddish?
I wouldn't say that. I'm not sure if your listeners would appreciate knowing about this phenomenon of this language that never really had a country, but it was spoken among Jews over many countries. And the way Yiddish was created was from High German, and then as Jews traveled through Eastern Europe, through Russia, through Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, they picked up with them words, and the words became part of the new Yiddish language. And then when they came to America in the turn of the last century, in the 1880s and 1890s, and the huge immigration, English, Hengelish, they called it,
right,
became the new lingua franca. So English became, woven into the Yiddish. So, but today, when you speak on the street to people, it's still as fractured as always. You go to Williamsburg and you hear this kind of Yiddish. You go to Crown Heights, you'll hear another Yiddish. So it's still fractured, but, people understand each other.
I guess it didn't occur to me that the Yiddish would be fractured from place to place in New York. Like, I was thinking in terms of Spain versus what would be left of in Hungary or people
absolutely,
there.
Absolutely, New York too, sure.
So I guess one of the things that the Volksbühne and you would want to push is that there are people under 30, let alone under 70, who are still learning Yiddish as a new language. Has that been continuing?
Yeah, absolutely. But, we've kind of re-looked at our mission. We're the longest-running continuous Yiddish theater in the world. Now starting our 101st year. When this theater was first created, it was for an audience that Yiddish was their language. So you had, on Second Avenue alone, 14 Yiddish theaters with 2,000-3,000 seats running 8-9 times a week. So you had huge audiences going and speaking this language. Today, our audiences are mostly non-Yiddish speakers who appreciate the fact that we do super titles on top of the set. So when they're looking at the stage, they can just look up on the set and they see the English translated. So I would say that 60 or 70% now of our audience non-Yiddish speaking, but they want to hear the language because the language has such charm and history and pathos and emotion. So we're kind of reinventing ourselves now as we look to audiences that are under 30 and in their 20s coming to see this phenomenon.
When I spoke with David, who is the producer of this radio program, and he used to see shows at the Volksbühne two decades ago, what you had, as he recalls, was you would put on headphones and you would hear actors talk in English in like one ear, and then you could hear the people on stage, the actors actually doing in Yiddish, and there would be translation, there would be like a woman and a man, the woman doing all the woman parts, the man doing all the man parts, if you'll forgive me for saying the word woman parts. But yeah. But did you still do that, or is it now all subtitle?
No, it's all supertitle.
Supertitle, yeah.
Supertitle, because it's on top. But yeah, what we felt, you know, years ago was that when you're looking at something and you hear, you're seeing a show with 18 characters, and you hear the translation done by one person on one voice, you lose the drama of it. And we wanted people to hear the language, whether they understood it or not. So because Yiddish has so many cognates of other languages, Polish, English, German, French, so many people understand words of Yiddish that they never thought they would.
Mm. And you get from context also. Sometimes you can take back in the day, you could take the headphones off and still get what was going on and just immerse yourself in the Yiddish kite, literally, of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. But now what we do is, as I said, we have the super title, so no one is left out in the cold, as it were.
Now, can I ask you, back again in the day, you had a few people left from the old Yiddish theater who were actually there when it was happening. There was Mina Byrne and Zabor Spiceman and people. Now, is Feivish Finkel the only one left?
Yeah, Feivish Finkel is pretty much the only one, and he doesn't really perform with us anymore. He, you know, we a couple of years ago, we did a show with him and his sons.
The xylophone guy and, yeah.
Yeah, Ian and Elliot did a show with them. And he did a one-man show very recently in a club in New York. But other than that, really, that's it. That generation is pretty much gone.
Because you do live theater, that's what you concentrate on, and concerts. But what do you have as far as archival material from the Yiddish years and from the earlier years of Volksbühne, or is that all over at YIVO and places like that?
We have some. The YIVO has a lot of older recordings of Yiddish theater, but we have a lot of our own recordings, not professionally done, unfortunately, of past shows. Starting in the 70s,
wow,
they start to videotape. But all the previous shows, you know, there's no movies of the shows or any kind of, you know, they didn't think of archiving those shows from the early, you know, when they started making movies. So we don't have those. But we have programs and we have some publicity about those shows, but we have very little in the way of archival material.
Well, I am curious, what is the first show that you videotaped that you have from the 1970s? Who was in it?
I wasn't doing it, so I don't know, but I know that, like, I know they have, I think, The Flowering Peach is one of the shows, I think they have, the Clifford Odets play.
Did they do it in English or in Yiddish?
In Yiddish. I think they also, they have a bunch of others. We've never professionalized them or released them. Only because of, you know, lack of funds, you know.
Well, yeah.
You're talking to a, you know, a non-profit organization that puts on a $7 million Broadway musical for $300,000.
Are you talking about those were the days, or are you talking about what you're doing now?
Talking about the show that we just did, The Golden Bride, that is coming back in July. We brought a 1923 musical back to life, with 20 people on the stage, a 15-piece orchestra. We've given a real snapshot of what a show on Second Avenue might have looked like and sounded like. The reviews were so phenomenal that we were sold out for the majority of the run. We just got two Drama Desk nominations.
Mazel tov.
Thank you, for Best Direction of a Musical and Outstanding Revival. because of the popular demand, we're bringing back the show on July 4th for the summer. So those of your listeners who would like to come see it and can come should know that they'll get a taste of it. And prices are, you know, significantly lower than anything, any theater in New York, because we're the Volksbühne, we're the people's theater. And we want to make sure that people, you know, people who can't afford hundreds and hundreds of dollars for Broadway tickets but can pay a couple something, can come and afford to see a great night of theater. So that's part of our mission.
Well, you're doing The Gelding Bride at the Museum of Jewish Heritage down on Battery Place. But let me ask you, is that one of the longer-term goals for you, is to get yourselves a theater that you yourselves own, so you don't have to go to this synagogue or that museum or that space?
Oh, actually, you know, we've been looking for a home for certainly for the 18 years that I have been involved. We're happy that the Museum of Jewish Heritage has invited us to have our permanent home here. What we're doing is transforming their concert stage into a theater space, and with God's help, there'll be another theater space here as well. This is our new permanent home.
Oh, mazel. Oh, so I didn't realize this was kind of a long-term base for you. Oh.
It was a very difficult decision about what show should we present for the first show at our new home. And we decided to come up with a piece of Yiddish theater history. And The Golden Bride, with it, because its score is so unusual and catchy and fun and delightful, we felt that this was the show, and the story is so universal because it talks about immigration, rich Cinderella kind of show. So it's a real crowd pleaser, you know, it has everything in it.
Well, we're talking about everything Yiddish here with Zalman Molotek, the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater, Volksbühne. Now, when you were coming through the ranks as a young musician, did the Yiddish stuff come a bit later? Well, I mean, you came from a Yiddish theater family, or Yiddish archival musical family.
Yeah.
But you went through not just Hebrew school, things like, I mean, you studied with major musical people. Were you ever pulled one way or the other going towards either classical music or pop? Or was your track always Jewish music?
Well, it's an interesting question. I was brought up in a home where Yiddish was spoken and Yiddish was sung. My mother was, Hannah Mlotek, who was one of the most important collectors of Yiddish folks and theater songs in our century. And she and my father, Joseph Mlotek, collected these songs and published songbooks that people use all over the world. And in many cases, the Klezmer music revival is thankful to them for doing that. So I grew up in this home playing the piano at an early age, and I went to music school, and I went to High School of Music and Art, I went to Juilliard, I went to Tanglewood, I studied with Leonard Bernstein, and my track was really to become an orchestral and choral conductor of classical and opera. But I was pulled by the Yiddish theater because I was a pianist, and I am a pianist, and I was called on by the Yiddish theater at the time when I was barely in my 20s to help them out, to write music, to conduct, to do things. And as I became more involved, I saw that there was a need for me in this little niche. And it was actually Leonard Bernstein, after a master class that I had with him in Tanglewood, basically said to me, he said, "Why does the world need another Traviata conductor when you know this music like nobody else and can perform it like nobody else?" So it took the maestro to kind of say that to me, that basically changed my life. I always add, you know, several thousand dollars of therapy also, dealing with, you know, which way to go, Yiddish music or, you know. Anyway.
It's the jazz singer all over again, basically.
So here I am, in celebrating my 18th year as the artistic director and finally having a permanent home in New York City. So it's quite a milestone for me personally and for the Yiddish theater in general.
Well, 18, that's the big number in Judaism, of course. But since you mentioned Leonard Bernstein, you've got to tell us a little bit of either what you learned from him or any funny stories about him.
Well, Bernstein, you know, was the kind of human being that, you know, when you connected with him, he was totally connected with you. You know how you talk, when you talk to people, they're looking at other things, they're looking around, they're looking at their cell phones, whatever. Bernstein was totally with you when you talked to him. I took classes with him at Juilliard, and I took classes with him at Tanglewood. One wonderful story that I love to tell is when I was a student at Juilliard, I think it was either 78. When was the Carter-Begin-Sadat Treaty? 78 or 77? We were one of four conducting students, four or five. You know, we had guest conductors come in to teach us and to work with the orchestras. And one spring day, word got out that Bernstein was coming to conduct the orchestra and to be there as a teacher for the young conductors. When a conductor would come, you know, the orchestra, the musicians wouldn't want to play in orchestras. They were soloists to be. But when Bernstein came, everybody came, wanted to be in the room.
Sure.
So you had the best, the cream of the cream of the Juilliard students in that year come and stuff the room. So imagine the room is packed with hundreds of students in the orchestra with people watching, and we're waiting for Bernstein. He didn't come in yet. We're all waiting, we're waiting. He comes in with his cape, smoking a cigarette, and he jumps up on the podium, and he says, "Jimmy did it! Jimmy did it!" And he's ecstatic. And no one knows what he's talking about. Well, everyone's looking around. No, Jimmy, I guess Jimmy Carter. What did Jimmy do? I happened to know, I was a little bit older, so I read the papers, and those of us who read the papers knew that Carter was brokering this the peace plan at Camp David with...
Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, yeah.
He jumps up on the stage, and he says, he did it. And he picks up his baton, he says, "Let's have a C major chord for Jimmy Carter." And everyone scrambles. They didn't have their instruments in their hands. Everyone scrambles to their instruments, and suddenly he conducts, and they all improvise a C major chord for the orchestra. Then he says, "Okay, and now let's have an E minor chord for Menachem Begin." And he does a smaller, softer gesture, and they play a softer, beautiful E minor chord. It was one of those moments that I'll never forget.
Now, can I ask you, what is the difference of what a Leonard Bernstein brings to a master class? What can he tell you that your regular professor does? What did you learn from his kind of conducting, besides taking things very slowly?
Bernstein, because he was such a bigger-than-life human, and you knew that music like West Side Story came from his head, and you knew of his creativity, and you knew of his just love of life, you learned much more about life and about loving the work than anything. While we learn technique and we learn to, you know, about how to stand and how to, you know, show tempi and show dynamics, what excited us, for me as a conducting student, was to see how little he had to do with his hands. It was because he was so focused in his head of what he wanted to hear, that he was able to communicate that with his eyes. That was a huge learning thing for me. And that's why I say to my students that you must maintain eye contact. You must make sure that your eyes are with your musicians, colleagues, and also an audience. Because when you're looking into someone's eyes, you're going to another level of intimacy. When you're hearing music and you add that level of intimacy, it makes for an extraordinary experience. So I have to say that was really one of the exciting things for me.
All right, but so then what different or what would you have learned from Zubin Mehta?
Well, Zubin Mehta, you looked at technique. You looked at his style. And I'm not saying it was all technique. There was plenty of passion. But the indescribable difference with Bernstein, it was something, I don't know, it was something that just was transmitted through his eyes, that he was able to transmit that. Hi, I'm Zalman Lutek. I'm the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater, and I'm speaking with Reb Sol Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Someone who seemed to have that kind of spirit also about music was the late Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach. And theater was, I think, the first place to develop and start the show Soul Doctor, which eventually came to Broadway and then even came to Broadway. It was not a hit at that point. But were you involved in the genesis of Soul Doctor?
Yes, we were. We were the first people to, after they did it as a memorial for Reb Shlomo's, 13th Yahrzeit, his anniversary of his death, they wanted to do a dramatic theatrical performance, and we invited them to do it in our theater. We did it for two performances, and it was a tremendous success. And then they went on and developed it and did it all over the country and developed it. It was on Broadway, as you know.
Did you see it on Broadway?
I did. I saw it several times, yeah. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful production. It was a wonderful tribute to Shlomo Carlbach.
Okay, so I'm wondering if it changed a lot from when you guys were
developing. Yeah, tremendous. It had to change because this was done on a shoestring budget, and it was done with, 3 weeks of rehearsal. So it was on a completely different level, the Broadway production. And they also developed the music more, and they developed the scenes. So it was a very different production.
Now, can I ask, did you have any misgivings about doing Soul Doctor owing to the stories that came out about Shlomo Carlbach after he died?
It's interesting. When we decided to do it, the people in my office who never knew of Shlomo said, what is this show? Who is this man? We don't know anything about it. So they went on the internet and they Googled Shlomo and they saw all these, allegations about, and articles about,
Bill Cosby kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And they said, how can you do this? And I said, we're talking about a man who had more influence on world jewelry than, pretty much anybody in terms of the music that he gave. Every segment of the Jewish population, whether from Reform to Orthodox to Reconstructionist to secular, everyone sings his music. And that's the music that came from him. And we are all imperfect, God made us all imperfect, starting from Adam and Eve. So the point is, if we're able to do important work, and if he was, how can you, based on whatever, on hearsay, negate the life's work and life's, huge monumental contribution that he made to, millions of people through his music. So that was how I answered my naysayers in my office, saying, how could I do this based on the allegations that they were reading on the internet?
You must have known him personally, did you?
I did know him personally, yes. I had the pleasure of accompanying him at a concert in Toronto once. I happened to be there. He happened to need a pianist, and I was there. Another time I was in Yerushalayim at the Western Wall, and I was going and he was coming to the Western Wall, and he was leaving with a flock of people, and I made the what I consider today a terrible mistake and didn't follow him. Instead, I just hugged and gave him a kiss and said good Shabbos and went to the wall instead of following him. But we crossed paths years later, so that was nice.
Now, you, as a person, are you Orthodox? Are you modern Orthodox? Where do you fall on the scale?
I'm a traditional Jew. At this point, I call myself. I keep Shabbos. I keep. I was blessed. I grew up in a secular home, but I was blessed to meet my wife, Deborah, who came from a modern Orthodox home. And although it was foreign to me, it's just a generation back. It was my grandfather, Zalman Luttig, Zichrono Livracha, who was, of blessed memory, who was murdered by the Nazis in Warsaw. He was a rabbi and a teacher, but he was an observant Jew. So the practices of observance were somewhere in my genes, and it just took my wife to introduce them to me, introduce them the significance of it all, and to welcome, you know, a higher power into my life, you know, a God that I never really had a relationship with
Wow.
all my life, because I was brought up, as I told you, in a secular Jewish home.
So your Jewish home did not observe the Sabbath, you're saying, or you didn't?
Yeah,
I mean,
we didn't observe the Sabbath. We didn't observe, you know, we observed the holidays, but not in a traditional way. I mean, you know, we did. It was not a kosher home. It was,
wow.
You know, we didn't. I didn't have any relationship with the synagogue or the liturgy or anything like that.
Well, Cass, do you miss bacon?
You know, I have to say, you know, every once in a while I think about the smell of a BLT. You know, I love that. But today, I can eat bacon substitutes and have the same smell. You know, the Orthodox food industry is, you know, I don't have to tell you,
of course.
So huge. So I don't really miss it. No.
Yeah, you can fry pastrami. That's good.
Yeah, you know, all of that. Lobster and shrimp, you know, sure, you know, they make imitation that now and taste just as good as far as I know.
Just as good, but it will suffice. But is there an irony, though, in the sense that the people who are literally keeping Yiddish alive as a language as opposed to sort of a cultural thing are the Hasidim, that sect of the Orthodox, and yet I assume they are not allowed and they do not attend shows at the Volksbühne.
Well, I have to say, you know, some of them come after the show goes down. They don't come in groups, but many of them do come. And I have to say that because of that, we now for the second year in a row, I'm producing a concert at Central Park with the leading Hasidic and cantorial singers of the world. And for the audience that will not come to hear women's singing
right.
or acting,
yeah.
Last year we had 4,000 people. This year I'm sure we'll have another 4,000 because we have, you know, the Maccabees and Zusha and Dudu Fischer and Lipa Schmelzer and all the leading Malavani and Natanael Hershtick and Yanki Lemmer. I mean, the leading lights of Hasidic and...
Oh, Yanki Lemmer, of course, yes. Wow.
Yeah. To a great and with a great band, and Avrami Gurari is the conductor. So it's a tremendous show that we produce. We did it last year at Summer Stage, and the audience went bananas. So we're doing it again this year. The Maccabees and Dudu Fischer will join us. So I'm doing this specifically for that audience, so that they come in and they see we're not treif. You know, we're doing something that is quote unquote kosher as well. So maybe they'll come and see what we do, and maybe they'll even come to see the theater.
Well, but they can't, as you said, they can't come to see if women are singing, and they can't bring their wives or whatever. I don't know.
You know, they don't come officially, but some do come.
Okay, pushing the envelope a little bit in a good way. Speaking about bringing things and bringing a wider audience, what was the experience like of bringing Those Were the Days to Broadway?
Well, that was very exciting because it was, you know, as you know, the first Yiddish English musical to be nominated for two Tony Awards. We had toured it all over the country before. We kept honing it and making sure that while we wanted it to be understandable, we wanted the sound of Yiddish to be there. And so that's what we did. We didn't have super titles. We just did it consecutively, Yiddish and English back and forth. So within the same song, you would hear Yiddish and English. And it worked, and it worked. We made it work. And some of the songs, you know, a lot of the things were in English as well. We had a great klezmer band, and the audience loved the show. I mean, it was a tremendous success, but the producers didn't have there's no idea that we were going to be nominated for two Tony Awards. Had they known, of course, they would have kept the show running, but the show had closed by the time they were nominated, so we didn't manage to benefit from that. But it was quite an experience.
And one other Broadway question, and this may be a mistake on the Broadway database, or I don't know if you guys were involved, but if you look on the internet, the Broadway database, it says that Volksbühne was somehow connected to, in a production way, the musical from last season, or two seasons ago now, called It Should Have Been You, which was that Jewish wedding comedy musical. Were you guys producers on that?
We were functioning as co-producers in terms of marketing. So we had an arrangement with them that we helped market their show and they helped market our show.
Oh, okay. What show, was it The Golden Bride or what show were they marketing of yours at that point?
At that time, I think it was Lies My Father Told Me.
Ah, okay. Zalman Molotek, the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, who, by the way, with his wife, will be honored on May 23rd at the Rose Theater of Lincoln Center by a concert by the one and only Mandy Patinkin. This is exciting. Well, he's done a lot of stuff with Volksbühne, right?
Yeah. Mandy came to Yiddish through Joe Papp. I was helpful in that. And because of his gratitude, he has appeared for us at numerous occasions.
Now, I tried to interview him a couple of years ago. It did not go well. He hung up in about 30 seconds on me, and he still owes us an apology here. He is crazy, but you work okay with him?
Yeah, we work fine. You know, he's an artist. You know, I don't know what happened, but I can just tell you that he's very particular about what he wants, and you know, he's made a tremendous career for himself. We organized a children's choir that's going to sing with him on Sunday. We organized a women's choir that's coming to sing with him. So people are excited to work to see him.
But in your experiences with him, you haven't had any weird or scary or strange moments. He's been fine.
No, nothing like that at all.
Oh, good. I'm just checking. So if you talk to him, tell him, you know, I'm still waiting for my apology. How's that? He won't give it, but just in case, I thought I would throw that out there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you two more questions specifically about the Yiddishkeit and the Yiddish. Do you have a favorite Yiddish song?
Oh, I can't. You know, I don't have a favorite Yiddish song, but I have many songs that resonate for me very, very much. A song actually that I may quote on the gala.
Oh, okay.
I may do a moment of it. And the text of it says, Lamilaunen, Lamilaunen, Lamilaunen von die welche haben gebaut. Let's learn from those who built. Und in Kampf sie mut nicht verloren. And in the struggle, they didn't lose their courage. Let's carry the spirit that we were entrusted with for thousands of years and bring it to a new generation. So it's a quite moving song that resonates for me very much because it's basically my life's work. If I could sing it for you, I would. But
Oh, please do. I mean, we're here. It'd be a cappella.
I have a piano. You want to hear it?
You betcha. This will be a great way to go out with Zalman Molotek, the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne. Remember, on May 23rd, he'll be honored at Lincoln Center's Rose Theater. And remember that the Volksbühne's The Golden Bride will be revived at the Museum of Jewish Heritage starting on July 4th and running through much of the summer. So you're probably going to want to see that. Two-time Drama Desk nominated The Golden Bride. So Zalman is sitting himself down at the piano. I want to thank him ever so much for being with us in the neighborhood. So tell us when you're ready, and we'd love to hear the song.
Okay, so can you hear me?
I'm going to raise the volume a little bit. I think we got it. Good.
So this is the song, as I told you, a song from pre-war Poland that says, let's learn, lamilaunen von die welche haben gebaut. Let's learn from those who built. When in Kampf they mut nit verloren, and in the struggle they didn't lose their courage. Lamilaunen dem Geist, was mir hat uns vertreut, scheint von tausend der Jahre. Let's carry this spirit that we were entrusted with for thousands and thousands of years. And it goes like this. Lamilaunen, 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 Lamilaunen,
Lotek. It is wonderful to talk to you about Yiddish and in English, hearing your music, hearing your spirit of keeping the soul of Yiddishkeit alive. I thank you once again so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. I look forward to greeting you at one of our shows.
I would love that. Shalom to you.
Shalom, shalom, and a good Shabbos.
You too.